Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Tony Fauci is science. Science is Tony Fauci.
It's very dangerous, Chuck, because a lot of what you're seeing as attacks on me, quite frankly, are attacks on science. Because all of the things that I have spoken about consistently from the very beginning have been fundamentally based on science. Sometimes those things were inconvenient truths for people, and there was pushback against me. So if you are trying to, you know, get at me as a public health official and a scientist, you're really attacking not only Dr. Anthony Fauci, you're attacking science. And anybody that looks at what's going on clearly sees that. You have to be asleep not to see that. That is what's going on. Science and the truth are being attacked.
That's it. Einhorn is Finkel. Finkel is Einhorn.
Tony Fauci is science. Science is Tony Fauci. You attack Tony Fauci. You're not attacking Tony Fauci. You're attacking science. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I watched that whole entire interview, and Chuck Todd, what do you call him, a yapping terrier?
Yapping little terrier.
Oh, he was so indignant. Like, oh, you've been so victimized, Dr. Fauci. Oh, my God, how can you survive? It was so insufferable watching these two, you know, go at it. It's like he's a victim because he's a victim, and poor woe is me.
You know what's interesting about Fauci's righteous indignation,
yes,
so he thinks, is that defiance speaks to something. You know, he feels
so defensive.
Well, he feels the pressure.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the attacks are just supposed to be, mouth breathing Trump troglodytes. No. We talked to Marty Makary, Dr. Johns Hopkins, yesterday, and so many others over the course of the last year plus that have been critical of Tony Fauci on the merits, that where Tony Fauci has said things on one day and contradicted himself the next day, where Tony Fauci has set down milestones, like we mentioned yesterday, August 13th of last year, when we get to 10 cases per 100,000, we can resume normalcy. Well, we got to 10 cases per 100,000 in mid-May. Where's the normalcy? Tony Fauci doesn't get those questions from Chuck Todd or from John Berman or from the MSNBC Zoo crew. So that's he's safe there, because then it's just about his personal reputation and continuing to also build him up so that the D.C. press corps doesn't look bad for building him up over the last year. This is all about, you know, both sides covering their backsides, the same way that Tony Fauci provided cover for the lockdown politicians and the lockdown politicians provide cover for Tony Fauci. You know what would be more interesting is for Tony Fauci, since he has had no problem weighing in on a range of topics associated with the pandemic that have nothing to do with public health, including the decisions politicians made, and pump the brakes. We don't want to open too fast, for example. Okay, we don't want to open too fast. How about schools?
Oh, by the way, schools on the West Coast in California, some schools are still not open. Still doing remote learning.
You got Burbio.com has a really good school opening tracker. Burbio.com, if you want to look at it. And they do state by state. California is the lightest shade of purple on the map, which is 20 to 40% of the students are in person, 20 to 40%. By contrast, Illinois, which is also terrible, it's in the bottom 10. Illinois is in the 40 to 60% are
in person. Wow, look at this map, burbio.com.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. It's looks like the sports map from the fall, who was playing sports and who wasn't.
So that would be interesting. Well, do you have anything you'd like to say to California?
What about the children whose lives you're ruining for no good reason, and he knows it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
The other thing that's happening to Fauci is he's getting criticism directly or indirectly from quarters that he's not used to. This is relatively recent. The last 60 days, I'd say, mainly. And that's parents and teachers.
Good.
And individuals that are concerned about kids' education, where Tony Fauci has chosen to stay silent. Let me give you another example, as we're wont to bring you. This is a public school teacher, a young public school teacher in Fairfax County, Virginia, who has children in the Loudoun County, Virginia school districts. Loudoun County is quickly becoming ground zero for this fight. It's fantastic because
I love it.
It's the richest county in America.
Good for them.
Listen to this Fairfax County public school teacher drop the hammer on that Loudoun County school board.
Fairfax County public school teacher, and I'm going to give a message of encouragement to parents and teachers and students who are too afraid to come and speak forward. Parents, the longer that you wait and you don't hold your child's schools accountable gives these guys more time to dictate what's best for your child's physical, mental, and emotional health. Don't be afraid to speak out for your kids because they are voiceless and they rely on you. You should be afraid of them rooting for socialism by the time they get to middle school. Teachers, it may seem that our careers have come to a dead end, but I'm here to remind you, we don't work for the school board. We work to mold the next generation of well-rounded American patriots. So don't give up because it is up to us. Students, you are on the front lines of these indoctrination camps. Challenge the staff when you are presented with a ludicrous statement, and do not allow anybody to tell you that you cannot accomplish anything because of your skin color or to hate yourself because of your skin color. Students, it is up to you to be the next generation of victims or victors. And finally, to the board, this isn't over, and your policies are just as...
Nick Gothard, followed by...
Yeah, they cut her off.
What? Oh, was there 2 minutes up?
Yeah.
I want her to keep going. This is great.
She said, your policies are as pathetic as making you wear a mask outside or something to that effect. But how good is that? Public school teacher, Fairfax
Love
County.
Her. Love her.
Carl on the south side.
And
yeah.
You're getting wound up way too early. Hear me out here.
All right.
You're going to stroke out. And to avoid that, do like Dr. Fauci says, because you're single. Go on Tinder and get a Tinder date.
But make sure you put that you're vaccinated first.
Thanks, Carl.
You might get more action.
Is Tony Fauci, is he a spokesperson for Tinder now?
No,
did
he
I
did.
Miss that?
No, he did. He talked about that. He said it's great that all these dating apps and websites,
yeah.
And he said Tinder, Bubbler, because he didn't know what they were, he said, are putting up there that I was vaccinated. So you can meet somebody who's also been vaccinated.
Again, it's great that he weighs in on relationships and how people can meet people. How about how people can educate people in school? Any comments there?
No.
Will and Skokie.
Hey, how you doing, guys? As an actual scientist, master's degree in physics, Fauci is more a government bureaucrat than anything else. And generally, people who work for the government are people who are really not in the top of their fields. Otherwise, they'd go work in the private sector and make a whole heck of a lot more money. I'm reminded of early in the Soviet Union, Lysenko came up with socialist science and wound up killing millions of Ukrainians because he was telling them how to plant potatoes and stuff, even though they've been doing it for hundreds of years.
Yes, right.
Better. So anyway, Fauci is a government bureaucrat.
Thanks.
And that's it.
Thanks, Will. Appreciate it. Well, here's the thing, though. That once upon a time, that was probably true, certainly when Fauci started. But he is the highest paid employee in the federal government. And I don't know if you've taken a look at the pension deal that federal employees get.
Pretty good.
So, making 400 grand plus that pension he's going to have after 30 years. You know, he's not a non-wealthy man.
No, and he won $1 million, guys. Remember that prize that he won for his dutiful work during COVID from that Israeli firm?
And, of course, the other advantage he has is you can't get fired. So you have guaranteed income for life regardless of performance. So it's pretty attractive.
Well, that's why his wife is looking at property in Europe.
Ray in Barrington.
Good morning.
Hey, morning.
Senator Kennedy from Louisiana had a perfect yesterday. We need to get Dr. Fauci a support pony.
And easy with the support animal.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that I think we're all getting wrong and talking about, gain of function. And the vast majority of people, I don't think, understand gain of function. What it is, it's man-made.
Right. Yes, weaponizing viruses. Yes. Thanks for the call, Ray.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
If you keep talking, I'll leave.
An AM560.
Just a loudmouth.
The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Welcome back to the program. We're pleased to be joined now by our friends, the Kolsak brothers. These are the Turnkey Boys.
Get it right, Dan.
We say it after every guest we have on, and we've got the Turnkey.pro answer line. We've got the Turnkey.pro text line. Who are the gentlemen behind Turnkey.pro? David and Louis Kolsak. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Good. So tell us where things stand in the IT biz coming out of the pandemic, particularly for those small to mid-sized businesses who comprise a significant portion of your clients.
Well, I think many people have just gone remote. And again, to give you some context here, 30 million small businesses are in the U.S. Most new jobs are created by small businesses, and about 30% either shut down or were severely impacted by COVID. So when you're talking about that group, which is exactly who we call upon, they were significantly impacted to the downside this last year. And most people from an IT perspective went remote, and all of their employees, including my own, are slowly, and I mean really painfully slowly, returning back to the workplace. And so that's the challenge right now that we're seeing with many of our customers.
So what are 3 to 5 takeaways that Turnkey can offer small businesses to help them overcome challenges or take advantage of growth post-pandemic?
Yeah, well, this has been a challenging time, and it's kind of hit businesses in two waves, the first being the shutdown itself, but the second is really the coming back and needing courage to step up. So I would say a couple of things. Number one, I would say in terms of you need to do something. Don't just assume that business is going to come back. If you have a business, you know that things have changed. And so you've got to figure out what's different. What's different from your customers? What's different from your employees? And you need to do something about it. Second, I think technology, and we've seen this, everybody's probably who's listening is probably used Zoom or something like that. Technology has changed things. And so think about how to use that technology to make your businesses better. Maybe that's accelerating the sales cycle. Maybe it's doing something different with your employees, but you can do something different with technology. And then lastly, as David talked about there, the whole question of engaging your team, things have been shuffled, and it's about employees, it's about customers, it's about business partners. We are figuring out who's on our team and who's not. And so I think having the courage to figure out who to bring in, who who to put in the right places, I think that's a reconfiguration is what's happening right now in the marketplace.
Yeah, and I want to add to that, like there's a realignment that's happening in the world. I think people are trying to find people on their own team, on their own tribe, with their own ideals. And so, you know, from a conservative basis, you know, we're conservative people, and we want to work with people who are like-minded. And we're finding that now more than ever, people are really coming together and wanting to feel that warmth and comfort, that knowing that they can at least check that box and say, at least this guy's on my team. And that realignment is really significant right now.
Yeah, I mean, and that sort of speaks to these recommendations that you're offering. They're not just the recommendations of a passive observer. These are recommendations that you've applied to your own business.
Certainly, and that's why we added the consulting arm to Turnkey, because in the middle of the pandemic, I sat on my couch like everybody else with my hands up on my head and saying, what can we do to make sure that, you know, we do our best to keep our customers alive, to keep ourselves alive, and to do the right thing? I think that's really the genesis of this.
And so what are some examples of what you've done for your clients?
Well, so the biggest thing we do is we help them take and get an external perspective on the business. So we do a lot of business assessments where we look at an entire business. We help them identify specific opportunities and where they can grow the business, get more revenue, we cut costs. But then from that, we find other ways like improving the sales process, creating an online sales strategy or a pricing strategy or employee incentives, really looking for new sources of revenue. So it's wherever that assessment leads us is where we can help.
And so that necessarily means sort of integrating with these businesses to the extent that you need to communicate with their web providers, you know, the e-commerce portion of some businesses and so forth. So, you know, you have to sort of put all the puzzle pieces together with vendors that are relevant to their technology infrastructure.
Yeah, that's right. And it's helping them connect the dots. It's helping them come up with the strategy, but then it's also being able to help them connect the dots with those partners with that specific website presence. And so we can do that, both the design side of it, the figuring out part, and then the implementation, the action part. And I think you're seeing, Dan, here a lot of paralysis. A lot of people in this time period are paralyzed. They don't know. They're waiting for a sign. They're waiting for, is the vaccine going to work enough where we can go back to normal? Or should I do this? Should I do that? And so a lot of small businesses that I talk to, they're paralyzed. They're kind of fearful to make a move one way or another. And so we're trying to give them the confidence that, you know, do an analysis of where you are today and figure out where you can go tomorrow, that you can really be successful and not be afraid, not be paralyzed.
Well, I think they're trying to figure out who's going to come back to work and, you know, what they should do in terms of their physical office footprint, as well as, you know, the dealing. You see the survey results. You're, I'm sure, reading the same articles that we are. See these survey results about people's, especially younger people's, disinclination to come back to an office setting. You know, a lot of people in different industries liked the working by Zoom and working remotely. And so that speaks to those reconfigurations you're advising on.
And you know, sometimes it's a relaxed approach to bringing people back and giving them confidence, you know, slaying their fears and getting them back maybe one day a week or slowly back into the office. And again, it's different for every business. But one thing we're doing is we're doing something called the Take Back 2020 promotion, which is, you know, if your business has 20 employees or more and you were down 20% last year in the year 2020, we're going to do a 4D business analysis, which is basically a four-dimensional business analysis for you for free in exchange for a testimonial in the future. Because we believe very strong.
That's good. It's very Herman Cain-ish, 999-2020. I see what you did there.
He was a good man. He was a good man.
Yes. And do you have a new phone number you want to tell us about?
Yeah. Call me directly at 847-850-7940. I'm happy to talk to business owners and people that are struggling and see how we can help them. And again, we're trying to connect conservative people with other conservatives and create a marketplace that makes sense, where people are comfortable and people can actually thrive and succeed, you know, in that marketplace.
And again, that number is 847-850-7940.
These are the gentlemen who keep us on the air and put our callers on the air and our guests on the air. Turnkey.pro, our answer line, our text line, Turnkey.pro. David and Lewis Kolsak are the proprietors. Gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. And guess what, Dan? They joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
There you go.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Because they got the beat, the campus beat, the campus beat. Yeah, the campus beat.
Alexander Riley is a longtime professor at Bucknell University. He writes in First Things, borrowing from Waylon and Willie, "Mamas, don't let your male babies grow up to attend a woke liberal arts college." "It is my considered view," writes Professor Riley, "that a parent with the best interests of a male child at heart should be intensely concerned about what he is likely to experience at a school like the one in which I work. Don't let your male babies grow up to attend a woke liberal arts college." The problem is, or the challenge that you have to overcome in people's thinking, is that eliminates virtually all of the so-called high status colleges in the country. Almost all of them. That, you know, where that credential is coveted. It doesn't mean you can't go to college. It doesn't mean that you can't get a good post-secondary education. But so much of college, particularly for people with resources and good students, even if you don't come from a family that's particularly wealthy, is about status, the status of the credential that you get after 4 years. He goes on to say, young men in institutions like mine are mercilessly stereotyped. They're compelled to unquestionably acquiesce to fundamentally anti-male social justice doctrines. I've heard people in important positions in my university, Bucknell, which is one of those status universities, heard people in important positions in my university talk unguardedly with disdain for white male students who are universally assumed to benefit from so-called privilege and harbor racist sentiments. The increasingly dominant view at woke liberal arts schools is that all white heterosexual males are the same. They're faceless representatives of, you know, the top spot in the power structure. In my classes over the past few years, I've watched a particular scene play out again and again. During class discussions, the topic of sex difference comes up. I teach on it routinely in a number of courses. Some students evince unhappiness with my discussion of the biological facts that show the sex that sex differences exist. They invoke the patriarchy to buttress their arguments that women are oppressed, men are their oppressors. One of them then argues men dominate public space, including the classroom, talking aggressively and crowding out female voices. I indicate to the speaker that in the entirety of our discussion of this and nearly every other topic in the course, men have been largely silent in class, and that it is in fact women and almost exclusively feminist women, such as the speaker, who talk constantly. The observation is never substantively challenged. It's just received with frustration. He goes on to say, the men in class sit quietly and look around the room uncomfortably, hoping no one will ask what they think about the matter. I often hear from them via email or in office hours, during which they're careful to ask me to close the door so their candid thoughts will not reach the ears of my colleagues in the hall. I wonder, as I talk with these young men, how any loving parent can imagine that this kind of environment is best for their sons. You know, again, a statement coming from a guy who's been teaching at a university like Bucknell for 20 years. I mean, what he's describing, I know we've talked about a lot, and our listeners are pretty woke to the reality of wokeness on college campuses. But taking that next step, that decision to say, you know what?
Don't waste your money and send your kids here. But he even took it a step further. You know, their manhood's in question if they go to Bucknell. I mean, don't do it. It's abuse. Don't send your kids there.
Yeah, and it also speaks to, you know, being just very particular if you're going to go ahead and do the college thing. Again, it's not saying you shouldn't, but it's a recognition of what the culture is. And frankly, you know, what kind of guy you're going to send there. I mean, if you got somebody like me, for example, who relishes the fight, then go ahead and send him to Northwestern or one of these totalitarian re-education camps, because that he's going to, you know, take on the machine on campus. However, if somebody is perhaps less, I don't know, stout of heart or less interested in that sort of never-ending intellectual combat, then, you know, I think you got to think it through. And by the way, this isn't just at elite universities. There's a meeting tonight at the Illinois Valley at Illinois Valley Community College. Illinois Valley Community College. So, you know, oh, go to the community college, knock out your gen eds. You won't have to deal with the campus culture. Oh, really? Illinois Valley Community College in Oglesby. So it serves, you know, Grundy, LaSalle, Bureau, Lee counties, and so forth. Meeting tonight to talk about some questions that were posed in a class at IVCC. Here was the assignment for the American federal government semester exam. Exam questions and then the admonition. Explain why it is time to get rid of the Electoral College. Explain how far right-wing media is negatively impacting American democracy. Oh, provide evidence that the 2020 election was legitimate. Do not do the opposite. Information supporting conspiracies about the election shared here will result in a zero.
That's a little extreme. Okay.
Here's the position you must defend and believe. And any suggestion that it's not time to get rid of the Electoral College, it's not, you know, should we or should we not explain your position and address the arguments of the other side. It's you know, probably rinse and repeat what I told you in class about why we should get rid of the Electoral College, why right-wing media is negatively impacting American democracy, and why the election was legitimate despite what the concerns people have. That's at IVCC tonight at 6:30 p.m. There's a meeting.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Mara Gay is an editorial board member at the New York Times. The Gray Lady, the paper of record. She was on one of those interchangeable MSNBC agitprop shows the other day.
Yeah, I watched it and fell off my chair.
She had this to say about Trump voters, effectively, and the threat they pose to our democracy. And it's time to ratchet up our appreciation for the threat that, you know, people like you listening who voted for Trump pose to our democracy. And particularly if you're, driving around in a pickup truck with an American flag waving.
The reality is here that we have a large percentage of the American population. I don't know how big it is, but we have tens of millions of Trump voters who continue to believe that their rights as citizens are under threat by simple virtue of having to share the democracy with others. I think as long as they see Americanness as the same as one with whiteness, this is going to continue. We have to figure out how to get every American a place at the table in this democracy, but how to separate Americanness, America, from whiteness. Until we can confront that and talk about that, this is really going to continue. I was on Long Island this weekend visiting a really dear friend, and I was really disturbed. I saw, you know, dozens and dozens of pickup trucks with, explicatives against Joe Biden on the back of them, Trump flags, and some cases just dozens of American flags, which, you know, is also just disturbing because essentially the message was clear. It was, this is my country. This is not your country. I own this. And so until we're ready to have that conversation, this is going to continue.
And then Mika just let it go. Just let it slide across home plate. Didn't question her at all.
She didn't let it go. She said, "I completely agree with you."
Yeah. Then they, you know, she didn't push back at all.
By the way, the word is expletives, not explicatives. New York Times editorial board member Mara Gay. Expletives. Oh, expletive laden bumper stickers of a political nature. Has anybody ever seen an anti-Trump bumper sticker?
Yeah, just drive across the country.
Sign.
And where they say F Trump on the bumper sticker, it's an expletive.
Yeah.
But, I mean, American flags are disturbing now. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
She said a little bit more than they're disturbing. She said they're a signal that that person thinks they own the country to the exclusion of others. You're not going to let Mara Gay participate in your democracy. You're going to not let what she's really saying. BIPOCs, Black, Indigenous, people of color. You're not going to let them participate in your democracy because you're a Trump voter and you're a racist and you're your privilege is the product of systemic racism going back 240 years and you're a bad person and you need to be marginalized before you marginalize people like Mara Gay, who've only been able to get in this racist society a phony baloney job on the New York Times editorial board.
I mean, it feels like they hate America with a comment like that. And why, you know, what do the Democrats want their own flag, their own version of the American flag? It's exhausting. And then she tried to defend herself too. I know I was taken out of context. No, you weren't.
Okay, well,
the next day she said I was irresponsibly taken out of context.
Well, what's the context? Add context. Explain it to us. You just heard. I mean, you just said what you said, which is Trump flags, pickup trucks. I mean, that's not a caricature. That's like that ad they tried to run against Brian Kemp, Governor of Georgia, with the pickup truck, you know, with the Trump sticker, with, I think it was a Confederate flag in that case, you know, because it was even more over the top than Mara Gay's comments, chasing down some brown skinned kid. And it was, you know, this was the governor's election there, Kemp versus Abrams.
They're trying to prove that, you know, Trump supporters are sinister and they drive pickup trucks and wave American flags and they're going to get your children.
You're a bunch of ignorant, racist hillbillies. That's 75 million Americans who voted for Trump. Now, she would say, no, there's a small element. It's the insurrectionists on January 6th. Really? No, it's not. It's anybody who questions the party line, their party line, on anything related to the pandemic, anything related to January 6th, anything related to any assertion to the end of humanity as we know it, because of the possibility we could see about a little less than a 1 degree increase in global temperature in the next 75 years. Any sort of pushback, questioning, presentation of evidence that suggests that what they're saying may not be true, and you're the problem. You're not sharing your democracy.
Well, the New York Times communications director said, you know, Mara Gay's comments were taken out of context. Her argument was that Trump and many of his supporters have politicized the American flag. The attacks on her today are ill-informed and grounded in bad faith.
She just said she just said it's basically equivalent to whiteness. She said waving it or displaying it on your truck, I guess, if you have one, is saying I own the country to the exclusion of the fact that you own the country as much as I own the country, as much as the guy down the block owns the country.
This is my country. This is not our country.
So whatever. I mean, it couldn't be clearer. It's just the same old race hustle rap. It's the same old anti-Trump agitprop. And oh, by the way, it is worth noting, you know, there's these reports that continue coming out that give lie to the mythology people like Mara Gay were spreading during Trump's presidency. The latest, the Inspector General of the Department of Interior yesterday on police actions in Lafayette Park. Remember, they cleared Lafayette Park
for a photo op with him holding the Bible in front of the Episcopal Church.
It found the U.S. Park Police on June 1st, 2020, cleared the park to allow the contractor to safely install the anti-scale fencing in response to destruction of property and injury to officers from rioting.
Oh, no.
The
truth hurts.
This is, you know, and how was this described? Elizabeth Warren, for example, Wall Street Journal notes, called it sickening and appalling. She called for an investigation in Attorney General Barr for the sickening and appalling clearing of the park. The investigation found, quote, no evidence that the Attorney General's visit to Lafayette Park at 6:10 p.m. caused the park police to alter its plans to clear the park, which it had the authority and discretion to do after the violence which injured 49 officers. And the DOJ, under Attorney General Merrick Garland, the Biden administration DOJ, asked a federal judge to dismiss a lawsuit against Barr relating to the events at Lafayette Square. How much attention is this going to get? Are you going to get people walking back in all their irresponsible, hysterical comments June of last year as they're trying to demagogue anything they can demagogue to put it on Trump, to put the violence that was occurring in the streets of America on Trump rather than on the Marxist Black Lives Matter Antifa crowd and the politicians in D.C. who run cover for them.
Again, so what they thought they knew was not reality.
Tell me more about sharing the democracy. Tell me more about being forthright and honest. Tell me more about your values, Mara Gay, et al. And what do we know from the Senate report? The 95-page Senate report released this week on January 6th. The insurrection, as they would call it, the coup attempt, as they would call it. We find out that the FBI knew things in advance that never got to top local law enforcement, meaning Capitol Police. One other notable finding in the report, an assessment of the National Guard's 3-hour delay in responding after police were overwhelmed.
Yeah.
It paints a picture of the Pentagon and the Department of Defense worried about optics. From the report, Senate report, the Department of Defense's response to January 6th was informed by criticism it received about its response to the civil unrest after the murder of George Floyd during the summer of 2020. The public presence of National Guard troops amid the D.C. Black Lives Matter riots in June met fierce liberal and media, I repeat myself, backlash. This led to a series of control measures on the National Guard, according to this report, including new hurdles to the use of QRFs, quick reaction forces. On January 6th, police asked for assistance, Capitol Police, at 2:30 p.m., shortly after rioters breached the Capitol. But the report says the Pentagon spent the afternoon assessing the situation, determining how best to provide assistance, instructing personnel on the mission, ensuring personnel were properly equipped. The D.C. police chief said the Pentagon was concerned with the optics, you know, how this looks with boots on the ground at the Capitol. And they were gun shy, if you will, because of the criticism of deploying National Guard to keep the peace in America's streets in the summer of 2020. So tell me again about what happened, and this was a coup attempt, and the FBI is such this wonderful agency beyond reproach because of Jim Comey and to some extent Christopher Wray. Meanwhile, the FBI can't even communicate with police locally after they are aware of chatter online about a small number of people that are looking to do some stupid things on January 6th, which of course happened. But this is all on Trump. Trump instigated all of this. It was unpreventable. Of course, none of that's true. None of that's true.
And again, they had decided hours before to put up that anti-scale fencing.
Well, right. In terms
right,
of
but I'm just saying people need to. That needs to be hammered home because no one's going to talk about it. They briefly did on MSNBC. They briefly did on this ABC News Live thing.
You know, throw that
but
on.
Didn't make mainstream media.
Throw these right next to the DOJ Inspector General report on Comey, McCabe, and the boys over at FBI. Throw this on the same pile with the whitewashing of the lab leak theory up until, you know, 2 weeks ago. And then, you know, settle in to be lectured about sharing the democracy by Mara Gay at the New York Times. I mean, honestly. Bob in Atlanta, Georgia, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, I got one better. So clients come into the office. They want to sue Lowe's because Lowe's is now taking down his veterans that have served in the military because somebody complained in California. And this now has become a nationwide edict from headquarters in North Carolina. How do you like that?
A nationwide edict to
you broke up there.
To take what down?
The pictures of the, you know, you got employees that are veterans. So they're in their uniform.
Oh, I
or
see.
Just even in street clothes. I served in the Marine Corps, and they put the year and the name. Somebody complained in California. They took it down.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, right.
There you have it. There you have it. And then you try to get a hold of Lowe's, and all you get is a runaround.
I've seen those kiosks. Yeah, they put them up, you know, for Veterans
Thanks.
Day, Memorial
Thanks for the call,
Day.
Bob.
They're people that works for Lowe's. It's, you know, it's real nice. They have a beautiful one in Tucson, or at least they did.
Well.
Somebody complained. Well, go pound sand. Did you serve this country? Did you put your life on the line? No.
I guess we don't get to share our democracy with the men and women in the military, according to Mara Gay. Joe and Lombard.
Hey, I'm also a Marine veteran, by the way. I served in the Gulf War. This is driving me crazy. Where is this whiteness thing coming from? Like, if I, you know, I vote Republican, right, or I support Trump. Where did this, you know, you support Trump, that has something to do with whiteness. What is she talking about? I have no idea what she's talking about with this whiteness thing.
If America's a racist country, hardwired into our DNA because of slavery, the original sin, the flag represents this oppressive country in which Mara Gay has been relegated to the prison camp of the New York Times editorial board because she's a person of color. And when you're waving that flag, or when it's on the back of your pickup truck, because all white people drive pickup trucks, as you know, And,
but Dan, did you notice no one ever talked about that before Trump was president? No one talked about that when Bush was president or when Obama was president.
Thanks for the call, Joe. Well, they don't talk about it when Obama's president because, you know, now we have a chance to right all the wrongs. They, you know, people forget Mitt Romney was Hitler. George W. Bush was Hitler. Ronald Reagan was Hitler. I mean, it's the same rap. It's just Trump is such a unique personality and he generates such intense reactions because he's always on offense in a way those other gentlemen I mentioned were not against the sort of allied elite power structure in this country. All of those institutions that we spend so much time discussing, which are all crumbling under their own woke weight. It was a paradigm shift, not to mention what has been built up in this country over the last 30 to 50 years as Marxists have gained a stranglehold on all these institutions, media, academia, K through 12 school systems, your bureaucracy, the administrative state at the federal and a lot of state levels. It's gotten more and more radicalized, less and less tolerant, hasn't it? And so Trump was, as Victor Davis Hanson finally wonderfully wrote, his value proposition in 2016 was all those people you know in all those institutions I just named, I know them all too, and they're even worse than you think. And I'm essentially going to be the guy that takes the bicycle chain to their playground. And that's what he did. And they didn't like it. I mean, obviously, over the top, they suspended any pretense of fairness when it came to covering a president. Formally, they announced it before he was inaugurated. And then, of course, how many stories do we have to document about what has happened and from corporate boardrooms to K through 12 classrooms? They have a definition of this country and the symbols of this country, like the flag, when displayed by people like me or you, Joe, the Marine veteran in Lombard, we're a couple of white guys. You know what that means? We're getting together a posse to go hurt
people. Lock your doors.
To go hurt people of color or some such thing.
Close your windows, lock your doors, protect your women.
All they have is turning people into cartoons because they cannot defend their views. They can't sell their views on the merits. Greg in LaGrange.
Hey, good morning, guys. My suggestion is you just have to fight back every day. They're counting on, it's amazing to me that they're using discrimination to fight discrimination. And one of the things that they do so effectively, because the media is in on it, all in, they're pot committed to it, that they'll make an outrageous statement and let it hang out there like a giant meatball and leave it out there. And then maybe later they'll come out and say, oh, well, we were wrong about this, just like the DOJ report about what happened at the church with AG Barr and President Trump. You just have to fight back. And part of why you see this happening now is you're starting to get pushback, especially at the level with some parents in the clips that you played, questioning a lot of this stuff. It doesn't fly. And what they hate is the realization that some people are waking up. And what I like to tell people, whether it be at church, on the street, at work, anything, challenge the language every day. Push back on what they're saying. Question some of the terms they use, like equity. I think what you need to do, what everybody needs to do, is to realize that if you hide, you're not protected. You will be eaten. You may be eaten last, but you will be eaten. So I think it's in everybody's best interest to learn how to fight back and push back and push for a common platform where we could discuss ideas as rational human beings, as opposed to radicalized, ideological Marxists or whatever term you want to make up on for these people that believe what they believe. Thanks, guys.
Thanks. Yeah, I go back to that Oak Park teacher that we profiled, the couple, the two CPS teachers, one a white guy married to a black lady in Oak Park, critical of critical race theory. And she basically said, you know, education is what got me ahead, not activism. I love that. And that's when we flipped that. And so, these institutions have flipped that. And in terms of the media and the truth. I mean, I just to paraphrase Churchill, you know, occasionally the D.C. press corps stumbles over the truth, and then they pick themselves up and hurry along as if nothing happened. And that's how they're going to approach these stories that we were just talking about, per the mythology they were spreading about Trump and these the events of these relevant days in the last year. John in Crown Point.
Yeah, hi, Dan. Hi, Amy. I could have swore that, you know, Trump set records for minorities voting in Republican races. I don't understand this whiteness thing. Are they assimilating themselves now as being white?
Thanks for the call, John. Well, you just saw Byron Donalds, who is my future congressman. He represents Southwest Florida, Naples, Marco Island area. Great guy, great young black Republican conservative, and really sharp. He was denied admission to the Congressional Black Caucus. You know why? Because what I just said. Because he's a conservative. Right. He's a Republican.
So that's discrimination.
Well, I mean, so he's not black. What did Rush Limbaugh famously say? The NAACP should be renamed the NAALCP, the National Association for the Advancement of Liberal Colored People. And so that's what you get. Yeah, right. 32% of Latinos voted for Trump. 18% of black men voted for Trump. Are they authentic Latinos and black men, for example? I don't know. I guess you'll have to ask Mara Gay. Vince in St. Charles.
Morning, guys. Yeah, this is our country, and that's why those people kind of scare me. And when Dennis Prager talks about the left, I understand it more and more. They want to destroy America, and she said it. She meant what she said, and that's all I got to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Vince. Appreciate it.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one, Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and, you know, it's fun that all of the Obama administration tricks are back now that we have Joe Obama's third term. One of them, you may remember, which began, I think, or hastened the loss of confidence in the federal government and the rule of law, was the IRS scandal, the IRS targeting scandal in the Obama administration, going after people and organizations based on their political and religious beliefs in terms of whether or not they would be conferred, for example, 501c3 status.
Right, like Tea Party groups, correct?
Tea Party groups, pro-life groups, and the like. Nobody ever held accountable. Nobody ever charged with anything, even though they were clearly in violation of acting in violation of Americans' constitutional rights and arguably criminally doing so. Nothing happened. What about now? And the timing of this leak. So Axios publishes illegally obtained IRS tax returns of rich people. And what's the top line? People like Jeff Bezos pay no income taxes. Oh, really? He doesn't take his $80 billion in a salary. What a surprise! This is, by the way, the tax code that you all you institutionalists, all you beltway creatures set up, your lobbyists with the carve-outs and the special dispensations and the complications to set up all sorts of cottage industries. And then you decry people who take advantage of the loopholes that they are able to obtain.
They're legal. Right.
Or that, you know, essentially people obtain, lobbyists and other interested parties obtain for their benefit. You support rent-seeking, and then you don't like when people take advantage of what rent-seeking produces. Real consistent, as per usual, from the combine in D.C. like the combine in Chicago. But, you know, you don't just get your hands like – and not some, you know, mid-level flunky doesn't get their hands on these documents. So it might be interesting to find out who, probably at the higher levels, singular or plural, was able to get these documents and then get them over to Axios. I mean, that's also a violation of the law if people still care about that. And the timing couldn't be more interesting. Joe Biden is out pushing massive tax increases, even the suggestion of retroactivity. And now these wealthy individuals' tax returns are made public by Axios after being illegally obtained to make the customary point of the left that rich people don't pay any income taxes, which is why we should tax the middle-income people, which is essentially the sum and substance of their argument, although it's never presented that way. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Don Boudreau. He's an economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Don, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure, Dan and Amy.
What about this? It's not getting much attention, surprise, surprise, but this leaking of, a few wealthy people's tax returns.
I agree with your implication, but I take the implication that the timing here is very curious. Americans, I guess like most people, right? Many of us are envious, not me, but many of us are envious of rich people. And so we think the whole language, they should pay their fair share. What's the fair share? They pay huge amounts of money in absolute dollars in form of taxes. I don't really have anything to add to what you said, because you said it so beautifully. The tax code was set up in a certain way. Everything that these people did was perfectly legal under the tax code. The tax code is structured that way in order to get the thing passed in the first place. And so when people act in accordance with the tax code, whether they be really rich people or ordinary people, that's perfectly legal. And no one should be upset at people taking advantage of whatever provisions exist in the tax code. And that's what's going on here. But it's being painted. It's being portrayed, of course, falsely, as an example of how the rich are screwing the rest of us.
Right. And the other thing, though, too, is, I mean, just the IRS. I mean, this is the most powerful non-law enforcement or military agency in the federal government. And here we are again after the scandal I described a decade ago, in a version of the same place.
Yep. I mean, it's this is one of the problems that arises when constitutional limitations are taken off of government as we move closer and closer to a pure majoritarian, raw majority rule world. And so you get the politicians pandering to the crowd, and the crowd, of course, often wants blood. The crowd wants to seize or booty. It wants to seize stuff from other people, not thinking ahead two steps about what that actually means for the future, not just the future of the people whose wealth is seized, but thinking ahead about the future of those who are seizing the wealth. Because if you start seizing the wealth of people like Jeff Bezos, taking more of it, taking more of the wealth of productive people, they will become less productive. And as they become less productive, our economy will become less productive and our living standards suffer as a result.
So, Mr. Boudreau, yesterday we found out that the pipeline, which has been a political football for more than a decade, the controversial project, they're definitely pulling the plug on it for now. So how are we going to get the oil from Canada into the U.S.? Because our need for oil is not going to stop.
Of course, I heard this morning some naive person say, it's a good thing that this pipeline has been scuttled because our future lies in green energy. And so this is a prediction for many decades to come. We're still going to need oil. So the oil is going to come here by rail. It's going to come here by older pipelines. It's going to come here, I suppose, also by trucks. It's never been clear to me why these methods of transporting oil between our two countries, U.S. and our northern neighbor, why these methods are somehow less environmentally dangerous or hazardous than a pipeline. The pipeline, of course, is a symbol. And so the environmentalists don't really care that it's a safer and more efficient means of transporting petroleum products. They want to destroy symbols of the energy industry, of the modern energy industry, which makes our life possible. Without fossil fuels, we would be, well, most of us wouldn't even be alive, quite frankly. And so it's fossil fuels that keep us alive. But these people, they do not understand the importance of these fuels. And so they just rail away at the symbols. And unfortunately, they're having an impact. I think it's very frightening the degree of public influence these people seem to have.
Better for us to rely on our enemies like Russia and OPEC for our energy needs, too. I guess it's great timing that Biden is going to meet with Putin because he needs to put in an order.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, the environmental groups, trust me, as you know, within 24 hours, I'm sure they're going to send out brochures to their donor bases saying, you know, we have succeeded in shutting down the Keystone pipeline, and the donors will take this as some kind of victory, not understanding the calamity. It's not a calamity, this one thing, but not understanding that it's part of a calamitous movement to reduce our ability to provide inexpensive energy to maintain our lifestyles.
Now, there's the news out this week that there are 9.3 million jobs that are unfilled right now that businesses would like to fill. You know, it's a big number. It's hard for people to get around to get their arms around that and what the implications mm-hmm. are. So let me try to make this concrete by just using an example of how serious the crisis is. Fox 8 in New Orleans reporting that Larry Flint's Hustler Club in New Orleans is experiencing what they call a national exotic dancer shortage. So much so that they're offering a $1,000 signing bonus to any new or returning entertainer, as I like to call them. Uh-huh. National exotic dancer shortage. Now we got people's attention, Don.
Yeah. You got mine. You know, New Orleans is my hometown. Maybe I should go apply for
yeah. I don't know if they're looking for you, Don. Yeah.
Well, you know,
are you flexible?
Yeah, well, so you know, this is by now, unfortunately, old news. So the government is paying huge amounts of money, making it unprofitable for a lot of, or certainly unattractive for a lot of people to return to work, and so they people are staying on their couches, receiving their government checks, and employers are having a difficult time finding employees. And I just learned just now that includes exotic dancers.
Yeah. So, yeah.
No surprise, by the way. These kinds of things are predictable. Well, when you, as O'Connell once said, if you subsidize, if you pay for unemployment, you will get more unemployment.
Yep.
Right.
And that's what's happening.
Oh, but another great economist, Nancy Pelosi, said that unemployment benefits are stimulative. Is that not true?
Well, she said that, but I think we're seeing evidence now that that is not the case.
Mm-hmm.
They stimulate people to stay out of the workforce.
That's a good way of putting it. Don Boudreau, economist, author, professor, co-director of the program on the American economy and globalization at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Don, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. What women need. I'm here to tell you. Well, not exactly.
A radio segment by Dan Proft.
Oh.
What our needs are? 312-642-5600.
We'll get to that.
I know.
First, does 18-year-old Paxton Smith represent the future for women in America? Paxton Smith is a valedictorian. She was the valedictorian of her high school class in Dallas. And she used the occasion of her address to the graduating students, her fellow students, to offer this.
Okay. As we leave high school, we need to make our voices heard. Today, I was going to talk about TV and media and content because it's something that's very important to me. However, under light of recent events, it feels wrong to talk about anything but what is currently affecting me and millions of other women in the state. Recently, the heartbeat bill was passed in Texas. Starting in September, there will be a ban on abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, regardless of whether the pregnancy was a result of rape or incest. 6 weeks. That's all women get. And so before they realize, most of them don't realize that they're pregnant by 6 weeks. So before they have a chance to decide if they are emotionally, physically, and financially stable enough to carry out a full-term pregnancy, before they have the chance to decide if they can take on the responsibility of bringing another human being into the world, that decision is made for them by a stranger. A decision that will affect the rest of their lives is made by a stranger. I have dreams and hopes and ambitions. Every girl graduating today does. And we have spent our entire lives working towards our future. And without our input and without our consent, our control over that future has been stripped away from us. I am terrified that if my contraceptives fail, I am terrified that if I am raped, then my hopes and aspirations and dreams and efforts for my future will no longer matter. I hope that you can feel how gut-wrenching that is. I hope you can feel how dehumanizing it is to have the autonomy over your own body taken away from you. And I'm talking about this today, on a day as important as this, on a day honoring 12 years of hard academic work, on a day where we are all gathered together, on a day where you are most inclined to listen to a voice like mine, a woman's voice, to tell you that this is a problem, and it's a problem that cannot wait. And I cannot give up this platform to promote complacency and peace when there is a war on my body and a war on my rights.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. What do you think of the Gen Z version of Bella Abzug there in Dallas?
Well, she was, you know, passionate about it. Apparently, she scrapped her original speech just to talk about abortion rights, and that's not the time or place to do it, but nobody cut off her mic. They let her continue with her right to free speech.
What about the substance of what she has to say and what that represents about as to, you know, the path forward for women? What do you think? Has the last, including this third, the last three waves of feminism dating back to the late 60s, has that been great for women? Has it been good? Are you happy with the sum total of what has transpired over the last 50 years for women?
I think we've been given every opportunity that's possible. I don't feel like I've been discriminated against because I'm a woman. And
as you look around, you think that this is a healthier environment for women, America, a healthier environment for women than, say, your when your mom was your age?
Well, one difference between when my mom was my age and now, they have high school sports. They didn't have anything like that for women back then. It was just synchronized swimming or Girl Scouts. Those were your choices after school. Hmm. So, yes, we've come a long way.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I've had just as many female bosses, guys, as I've had male bosses. And I love them both the same.
Hmm.
Actually, my female bosses were a little bit better than my male bosses, if I'm going to be completely honest.
A piece by Frederica Matthews Green at Touchstone Magazine, What Women Need. Yeah, it's going to be her suggesting it, not me. Just being cute there.
Yeah, I see
my
what
effort. She showed up to campus in South Carolina, University of South Carolina in 1970, and she got all down with pioneers of so-called feminism as an undergrad. Find out what all this women's lib stuff was about. She wanted to, as they used to call it back then. And as she talks about her journey and reflects on what has transpired over those same 50 years I asked you about, she recalls some ideas that were good at the outset of feminism, modern feminism. Some ideas were bad. For example, and they died quickly. Some ideas were bad and they didn't die. One idea that died quickly, she writes, was women should live in a community and pool their children in a cooperative caretaking scheme. Yeah. Plato's Republic didn't happen because once we started having kids, we discovered we really didn't like how other people wanted to raise them. We wanted our own separate homes and personal control over child-rearing decisions. Then the government stepped in and became mom and dad. That's present day. That was my parenthetical addition, yes. Not her words. She goes on, an idea that had tenacity but didn't succeed had to do with images of women in advertising. One of my personal crusades in those early feminist days was to oppose the exploitation of women in advertising. You know, the selling, using sex to sell, basically.
Well, yes. Sex still sells.
A happier idea was that women should return to more natural standards of physical beauty as well. You may have forgotten how bizarrely artificial the idea of female beauty had become in the 60s. Everyone wanted to look like Jane Fonda and Barbarella, she writes. Yeah, that's sort of true.
That's true.
So there's, you know, some good and bad. But in terms of the main thrust here, three bad ideas survived. And now, as you reflect on the last half century, a damage assessment needs to be done. She suggests, I agree. Some ideas were bad.
Like the commune?
The greatest producer of grief was abortion. And interestingly, she notes, in 1967, when the National Organization for Women met for the first time, abortion and contraception were mentioned only briefly at the end of its Bill of Rights. Abortion appears only as the last word in the document. How did it become the most prominent cri de coeur? Because it was concrete. And it's intertwined into two other bad ideas. There are two other bad ideas from the 70s feminism, which can combine to create a current situation that makes abortion seem indispensable. The two other bad ideas, the idea that women should place career above child rearing. The other was that women should be promiscuous. And what happened? Why did those bad ideas survive? Why did feminists make those choices? There's a concept in sociology called imitating the oppressor. You actually see it going on now with critical race theory. When a group emerges to a new identity, it tends to first adopt the values of whomever it perceived as holding power. So what you have, people, for example, the civil rights leaders of the 60s, like the Bob Woodson and the Shelby Steeles, they had a vision. They had Martin Luther King's vision. They have Martin Luther King's vision for society. The radical elements, the Marxist elements, see this as just a power game. And so we're going to ascend to power so we can behave like our oppressors behaved. That's what's happening. So what did happen in feminism? We behaved. We said whatever men are doing, since they have the power, we should emulate. Whatever men value, we should value because they have power. Whatever men don't value, we shouldn't value because they have power that we want. That was the approach, because most of these feminists were Marxists, of course. As our friend here, Frederica Matthews Green, writes, if men wanted to sleep around, women must want the same thing. If men thought the workplace was more important than the home, women must think the same. Whatever the oppressor valued was assumed to be intrinsically valuable, and feminists fought for their share. So feminists concluded men were right about everything. Isn't that ironic? If men thought that housewives were dumb, that staying home and raising kids was mindless drudgery, it was so. It didn't matter that our foremothers for generations had found homemaking noble and fulfilling. What did they know? They were stupid housewives. We were embarrassed by our female ancestors and envied the males. They had power and we wanted power. We couldn't imagine any success except success in men's terms. And they call that feminism. Isn't that odd? Interesting. She goes on to say, of course, that there are three good ideas that need to replace these three bad ideas. Support pregnant women. And she talks about crisis pregnancy centers as one example, pregnancy care centers. offer grief counseling for post-abortion women, right? Abortion hurts women. It's not just about the baby. And restore young men to the role of husband and provider, which is the most long-term, most important long-term strategy for reducing the need for abortion, she argues. Agree. Straightforward. Nothing that you hadn't heard before. But maybe the reflection she did, Miss Matthews Green did, about feminism from its inception and where we find ourselves today, 50 years after that genesis, merits some reflection for the Paxton Smiths of the world, that Dallas valedictorian, for your daughters, for your friends who are female. You think you're a feminist because you're imitating men? Now we're in a place where you just say you are one. But I mean, without getting into that off on that tangent, that's such an important understanding to take away from feminism, which was again just an iteration of Marxism, generally speaking, at least for those on the left, because they were interested in power without consequence. They got power. Some of it's certainly good happenings, you know, more opportunities and so forth, like you were saying, Amy. Fine. But the sum total of what you've adopted, what so-called feminists have adopted, has it been good for women? And I think that's a much more complicated answer than it would seem at first blush. And it's interesting, too, that you start with opportunities. Is that the sum total of whether something, an enhancement to your life, there's more economic opportunities or more opportunities for extracurricular activities? Is that the sum total? Sum it up and tell me where we're at. Dawn in Crystal Lake, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, everyone. I am the proud mother of a daughter who is in this world as a result of my having been raped many decades ago. She's now 35. I am grateful that she is here, and I want to answer that young lady who gave the speech. Without my daughter being here, my family line would end. My siblings did not have children, and neither has my extended family had any children. So my daughter is the only hope of my lineage for the future. Furthermore, because I did not give in to the prevailing abortive mentality of the time, I am very grateful as a genealogist to be able to look back at generation after generation after generation of women who struggled from the founding of this country and indeed the founding of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And that chain continues because I brought my daughter into the world. It will make you grow up very fast, but you can meet the challenge. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Dawn.
Thanks, Dawn.
Nation in Aurora.
Hey, hi. You know, I have listened to, you know, all of the arguments, you know, and women and girls, you know, they talk about getting pregnant and needing an abortion like they get pregnant by standing out in the rain. Why isn't there more teaching and preaching to men and boys? And aside from that, they don't have to get pregnant. There's an emergency pill for that emergency sex that they have. Isn't that the craziest thing?
Emergency sex? Did you say they have emergency sex? That's sort of, you know, it was interesting how Paxton Smith, that young valedictorian in Dallas, how she referred to that, you know, choices being taken away from her. Of course, the first choice she had, she has, and every woman does, is whether or not to have sex. And then there are consequences that attach, including, and of course, for the man as well.
Sex.
That's the first choice.
Right. That's the first choice.
And I'm not excluding the men here, too. Same thing. And consequences that flow from that. You know, that is all stripped away because it's seemed like it. And it's interesting because it speaks to this culture that Frederica Matthews Green is properly describing. which is a sort of I have to do this in order to be powerful. I have to take advantage of the opportunities that my foremothers provided to allow women to behave like men, to allow women to mimic men. That's what you want to do? Wow. Isn't that groundbreaking? Thanks for the call, Nation. Isn't that groundbreaking? You're going to imitate the oftentimes barbaric behavior of men. What a feminist. Isn't it interesting? You're a real feminist. You're just imitating that jerk off at the end of the bar. Right? Or is that no? Tony in Downers Grove.
Well, Dan, I mean, you can talk, we can talk about the philosophical and sociological evolution of feminism, but I think the real issue is the gains that were made in Texas by Republicans. You could kiss that goodbye if this bill is actually what she purported it to be, because this is not a winner. When people vote, this is not a winner. We know this. That's historically factual by elections.
You're wrong.
So we can.
What are you talking about?
So you think that this bill that was passed in Texas, come midterms, this is going to be front and center, and you don't think this is going to be a wedge issue, and people aren't going to lean in that direction? Because it will be a wedge issue, and they will lean in that direction.
Yeah, it's a wedge issue because the Supreme Court in 1973 took it away from the states. That's why it's a wedge issue. And by the way, Tony, I don't know how much you've traveled around the country, but not every place is what DuPage County has become as and why DuPage County has become what it's become is because, frankly, of people like you who want to surrender on cultural issues because somebody might be upset. Sorry, I hate to break it to you, Tony. You're why the Illinois Republican Party is a fiction. You're exactly why Republican parties in blue states have ceased to exist when they were once in power, because they were inhabited at the highest levels, and currently the case here, by surrender Republicans who take rhetorical positions like I'm pro-life, I'm Kirk Dillard and I'm pro-life, out your way. But I'm not going to do a damn thing about it. And if you push me on it, I'll run away from it. When they come at me, I'm going to, you know, talk about how I'm, you know, standing with the teachers union as a proxy for having to be pro-life because I was in a Republican district. If he was in Evanston, he'd be pro-abortion. And there's no principle there. And there's no principle with your position. You think I care, or we should care, about the political implications of protecting human life? So we may get some suburban women to lean the other way in Dallas come the midterms. That's the most important thing? No. The most important thing is the underlying issue. The most important thing is living in a nation that respects human life from conception to natural death. At least that's how I want to live. You want to be a political animal and a loser on top of it? You want to continue to push the Republican Party into oblivion? Model the National Republican Party over what Illinois has become? God bless you. Make your case. You'll note that DuPage County has stripped out all of those moderate, you know, weak, basically pro-abortion or, you know, pro-life in name only Republicans, too. How did Grant Worley lose in Naperville, Tony, in Downers Grove? Judy Biggert got knocked out of Congress. These are all pro-choice women. They're soft. They'll go along. They'll surrender at the first sight of trouble. They're happy to do the left's bidding just at a slightly slower pace when they go to Lincoln Day dinners and shine on people like you. Say, oh, yeah, dude, Kirk Dillard, Dan Cronin, Judy Biggert, they're making sense. You have it completely wrong on the politics, number one. More importantly, on the underlying principle. That's what you want to live your life for? What may happen in the midterms in one seat or another in a couple of states? Wrong. And oh, by the way, going back to the survey research, the people who vote on abortion as their singular issue, as their animating issue that informs their vote, 2-1 pro-life. And particularly in states that are pro-life, like Texas.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Our friend Bob Woodson has an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal with some sad news. A guy named Carl Hardrick, who is known in Hartford, Connecticut as Brother Carl. I had the chance to meet Brother Carl at an organizational meeting for Woodson's 1776 Unites project in D.C. a few months back. Oh, well, actually, I guess it was last year already. Hardrick is a former gangbanger who has spent his life trying to bring peace between gangs in Hartford, Connecticut, and he has the credibility to do so. It was really interesting to talk to him. I think there's actually an interview I did of him on the 1776 Unites website, if you want to check that out, but he's really fascinating cat. The sad news is that, as Bob Woodson reports, McKee Buckley, the 19-year-old grandson of Carl Hardrick, one of our most faithful leaders in youth violence prevention, was fatally shot in Hartford, Connecticut on Memorial Day weekend.
Oh, God.
Student-athlete in his freshman year at American International College in Springfield, Mass. When Carl called to tell me the terrible news, his words broke my heart. It's my job to keep kids safe, but I can't even protect my own grandson. And the title of Woodson's piece is "The Deadly Results of Defunding the Police." You want to drive this home, bring this out of sort of the debate hall and into the real world. As Woodson notes, homicide rates in large cities up 24% since January. Criminologist Joseph Jackalone, an adjunct professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, former NYPD, predicts they'll increase even more this year. We've heard the same predictions about Chicago. As radical progressives continue to try to defund the police, our families, friends, and neighbors have paid the price. And now people like my friend Carl have to wonder whether a child's death could have been prevented if a police officer had been there to stop it. The defund the police movement has been a death sentence for innocent black children, writes Bob Woodson. For more on this, pleased to be joined by our friend Will Riley, also a part of the 1776 Unites organization and project with Bob Woodson and many other scholars. Will is a professor, assistant professor of poli-sci, Kentucky State University, and author of Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War. Will, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Sure. Always good to be back on the show, Dan.
And, I mean, just sort of your assessment of Bob Woodson's assessment as we stand here today.
Well, I think you and I both met and had a drink with Brother Carl at the 1776 event. So, I mean, that's a situation I hadn't been aware of that. I mean, I should probably call him personally, as you said you did. I mean, that's very unfortunate.
Yeah.
And I do think that, like, literally, you know, a buddy's son getting shot, that's a tangible representation of what we're talking about here. The idea of defunding the police, and defunding the police might not even be the proper term for what's going on. I think the bigger issue is that in response to protests, really trying to be good officers and work with communities, you've seen the police in a lot of major cities pull back stops. You're talking about stop and frisk. You're talking about gun stops by 60 or 70%. And if you look at, for example, the most recent Commission on COVID-19 and Crime report, that began literally the week after George Floyd's death. That was May, early June of 2020. And since that point, we've seen crime skyrocket. I mean, crime last year was up 32% over the previous year in the summer, 41% over the previous year in the fall. It's now up 24% again. I guess that would be 2021 over 2020, and that's when a Brother Carl's young son was shot. So, I mean, this is something that is a stupid idea that we've tried over and over again. We tried this in the 1960s. We tried this with maximum sentences. I guess that would be late 1970s. We tried this in 2014 after the first wave of Black Lives Matter riots. This has now been going on for 5 years. And every time what you've seen has been what's called the Ferguson effect, the Oakland effect. You've just seen increases in crime. So we obviously all want good, non-abusive cops, but where you have no cops on the block, and where you also don't allow citizens to own guns, by the way, if you look in Chicago or Baltimore, you see more crime.
Well, and speaking of Baltimore, by the way, I mean, this is, yeah, I guess, one manifestation of the revolt. More than 36 Fells Point business owners have sent a letter to Baltimore's mayor, Brandon Scott, and city council. The letter says, in part, what is happening in our front yard, the chaos and lawlessness that escalated most recent weekend into another night of tragic, unspeakable gun violence has been going on for far too long. The letter demands city leaders restore basic and essential municipal services. And if they don't, and get rid of illegal open air alcohol, drug sales, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't, the business owners are threatening to withhold tax and permit payments, placing those funds in an escrow account unless and until the city responds to their request. That's interesting. That could be an interesting moment.
Yeah, I say good for the business owners. I mean, we've seen this again. Everyone opposes police violence. We all want people to be sympathetic, so on. But I mean, I think you grew up in Chicago at kind of the end of that one movie kids era. You're talking about early 90s.
Yeah.
And it's fairly easy to have chaos in a large urban area. I mean, you get on the trains with your skateboard and school bag, and there are people painting graffiti on the windows of people having sex in the back of the train. You can buy drugs at the parks by every stop. That's obviously not the environment you want. And I think if you're a business owner, you have, although it might sometimes be entertaining in high school, but if you're a business owner, you have the right to say, no, I'm not going to pay taxes if I have prostitutes outside my place of business, or if I have in Chicago and every other big city, homeless encampments springing up, you know, under the overpass across the street, if I'm not being provided with basic services. And I think we've seen the apex of this in places like, where was Chaz in Seattle? Portland.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, George Floyd Square in Minneapolis, but where people have basically declared autonomous city states that are the size of small suburbs, and the police are literally not allowed to enter. They're armed guards. I mean, to me, it's unbelievable that this is frankly allowed to go on anywhere in the United States. You know, the agents of the government also have weapons. And yeah, I wouldn't pay taxes if I were living in one of those areas or in any area that was starting to resemble that.
Well, a new thing that
the basic idea of the social contract is protection.
What we're dealing with a lot here is reimagining, like you're going to reimagine the police department. And that includes there's a big call right now for social workers to come to domestic violence situations, which are, if you ask a police officer, they're the ones that they don't want to go to because you never know how that's going to end. But now people in Chicago are pushing for social workers to come first. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, I think that if you really wanted to look seriously at police reform, most of the real proposals I've read, which come from everyone from, you know, 100 black men to the major universities, would actually involve more funding going to the police. So if you're saying that what you want is two tough sworn officers and then a social worker going on a DV call, I think that's a good idea. If what you're saying is that you're going to reduce the cops to one or to zero and send, you know, an upper middle class, college educated, often female social worker instead, I think that's an insane idea, which again is going to lead to more crime and going to lead to some social workers getting badly abused or just frankly skipping the more serious calls or the calls at night. So there's an idea on the political left, just one sentence, but that it's easy to remake the world into utopia. Why do the police ever use their guns? Why couldn't we replace the police with mental health professionals? But when you try doing that stuff in reality, you run into the ugly, real problems in human life. And again, the more good cops you have, the less crime you're going to see as a big city.
The other thing, too, and you're always in this space of looking at data and trying to understand cause and effect, or if there is a cause and effect, sometimes there's a correlation. Sometimes it's a contraindicator. One of the narratives is the spike in violent crime you were describing over the last year is the result of the pandemic and the shutdowns. Well, Zaid Jilani, who was also similarly disposed, noted that Nature Human Behavior published a paper studying the impact of stay-at-home orders imposed worldwide to combat the pandemic. What they found was that the more stringent restrictions over movement in public squares, in public space, were predictive of larger declines in crime. And so the surge in murders all over the United States is anomalous. Canada saw no increase in homicides. Mexico saw a 0.4% decline in murders last year. El Salvador saw its homicide rate drop to a historic low, which is one of the most violent countries in the world. At least San Salvador is one of the most violent cities. So there's something unique going on here that has nothing to do with the pandemic or the shutdowns.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And again, the scramble here for excuses to justify the prevailing narrative vision is remarkable. And if I were on Twitter or something like that, I might even label it darkly funny. And we've seen this every time that this has happened, right? I mean, in the 1960s, you had Miranda, Escobedo, fruit of the poison tree, mandatory maximum sentences, all of this within a period of maybe 10 years, you saw crime surge. I mean, between 1963 and 1993, murders went from around 8,600 to around 25,000. But for a very long time, prior to Rudy Giuliani, prior to Freakonomics, the argument was, well, we can't just be, you know, racist or classist or whatever the tagline was and attribute this to the fact that we're not pursuing crime. It has to be due to, say, lead paint. There are all these excuses made. Right. But the reality is that people have been using, you know, metal-based paint in houses for a very long period of time, and we saw the crime surge only when the police were pulled back. And now it's more of the same. I mean, of course, there is no logical reason why requiring people to stay home all day would boost crime. You could argue that it would boost purely economic crimes as people got hungry. I'm an opponent of lockdowns. But if you actually look at burglary, hard drug sales, things like that, my understanding is that those offenses all decline. What you saw was an increase in rioting, an increase in fist fighting, an increase in murder. And it's hard not to link that to the giant public protests that went on for a year and often degenerated into riots. So I think we all, at a common sense level, know what happened, and we shouldn't be gaslit about that.
He is Professor Will Riley, Associate Professor of Poli-Sci, Kentucky State University, author of Hate Crime Hoax, How the Left is Selling a Fake Race War. Will, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and you know the Kafka book, The Metamorphosis, right?
Yes.
Right, man transforms into insect.
Into cicada?
Tony Fauci, Dr. Tony Fauci, he has transformed too. He has transformed into an abstraction, though, not an insect. Tony Fauci is science.
It's very dangerous, Chuck, because a lot of what you're seeing as attacks on me, quite frankly, are attacks on science. Oh, yeah. Because all of the things that I have spoken about consistently from the very beginning have been fundamentally based on science. Sometimes those things were inconvenient truths for people, and there was pushback against me. So if you are trying to, you know, get at me as a public health official and a scientist, you're really attacking not only Dr. Anthony Fauci, you're attacking science. And anybody that looks at what's going on clearly sees that. You have to be asleep not to see that. That is what's going on. Science and the truth are being attacked.
Oh, look at me. I'm the victim now.
So one wonderful transformation to criticize any, I guess, Centers for Control Policy, since he's a spokes being for the Centers for Control, is to criticize Tony Fauci, is to criticize science, is to be trafficking in untruth. So I'm sure this Fairfax County, Virginia public school teacher will be horrified at what she said after hearing from Tony Fauci. Here's how she addressed Loudoun County School Board, because she has kids in Loudoun County, and she brought the hammer.
Fairfax County public school teacher, and I'm going to give a message of encouragement to parents and teachers and students who are too afraid to come and speak forward. Parents, the longer that you wait and you don't hold your child's schools accountable gives these guys more time to dictate what's best for your child's physical, mental, and emotional health. Don't be afraid to speak out for your kids because they are voiceless and they rely on you. you should be afraid of them rooting for socialism by the time they get to middle school. Teachers, it may seem that our careers have come to a dead end, but I'm here to remind you, we don't work for the school board. We work to mold the next generation of well-rounded American patriots. So don't give up, because it is up to us. Students, you are on the front lines of these indoctrination camps. Challenge the staff when you are presented with a ludicrous statement, and do not allow anybody to tell you that you cannot accomplish anything because of your skin color, or to hate yourself because of your skin color. Students, it is up to you to be the next generation of victims or victors. And finally, to the board, this isn't over, and your policies are just as...
Nick Gofford, followed by Ryan.
Good innovation. Nice.
Got caught off there at the end, but
she's talking about policies on masks.
The crowd seemed to like this. Also, at Metro Schools in Nashville, an occupational therapist addressing the board there, but his experience working with students and masks.
Chair, I also work for the district. I serve as an occupational therapist. I don't have any data other than my observations, and I just would ask the board to consider the burden on the staff and the students to wear a mask. I work with all populations, typical, neuro, atypical. It is very, very hard for children to wear a mask appropriately all day. As an adult who is responsible for these children, constant reminders, constant masks, masks on the ground, masks in the desks. In theory, I see where a mask might be needed in certain situations. I even had students who couldn't wear a mask for medical reasons. They just couldn't, they just didn't have the ability to wear it all day.
Nor should they have to be wearing it all day.
Well, you know who has data on this? CDC, Centers for Control. They did a study at the end of last year that found no meaningful difference in infection rates between schools that required kids to mask and schools that did not.
Well, why isn't that blasted all over the mainstream media?
I wonder why.
Or brought up at school board meetings.
And yet the CDC sticking to everyone mask up in schools for the foreseeable future. But to criticize that policy, even using the CDC's own study, is to run afoul of Tony Fauci, and that means you're running afoul of science and the truth. Oh, heavens. What is one to do? We need somebody to help us. Dr. Joel Zinberg is the fellow that's going to try and help us. He's also the senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in D.C., associate clinical professor of surgery at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Dr. Zinberg, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Great to be here.
So you've been warned. I mean, I don't want you saying a cross word about Tony Fauci, lest you perhaps lose your medical license. I don't know. He is the embodiment of science, he says. Interesting how personal he's taking criticism he's receiving, given all the adulation he's enjoyed over the last year.
Well, look, you know, he's kind of wrapping himself up in the blanket of science, but he is a very well-known and respected scientist, but, you know, he's not the only or the last word. And as I think what we saw in the recent revelations about the possibility of a lab leak being responsible for the COVID-19 pandemic, is that scientists have actually been pretty poor in investigating some of the science early on. And that's really kind of the scandal, that scientists, despite a lot of evidence really dating from the very earliest days of the pandemic, that this could be a lab leak rather than a natural jump from bats to another animal to humans, they ignored that and sort of walked in lockstep to try to downplay the possibility of a lab leak.
Well, and knowing what you know, do you think it leaked from the lab?
You know, I don't know. I think I don't know that we'll ever know, because the Chinese have stonewalled every possible investigation, and they're likely to continue doing so. And it's really only when you look at what were they working on, and what kind of manipulations of the virus did they do that might have made it more infectious to humans, that we'll know for sure. And they're never going to give that stuff up, particularly not at this point in time. But I will say, I think, you know, there are two leading possibilities. One's the natural jump that I described earlier, and the other is the leaked from a laboratory, possibly from a manipulated virus, and it's becoming, I think, more and more likely that it's the latter, that it's a lab leak.
Part of the problem here, too, I want to go back to the masks. CDC's guidance versus the CDC's own study, and this is just consistent across the board with all of these guidances that have been turned into edicts that have been implemented at the state and local level in so many places. I mean, you can use whatever wordplay you'd like. This is how it's actually functioned in practice. And so, you know, how do you play this out? I mean, we're on the cusp of sending half a million or 500 million doses of Pfizer and Moderna vaccines around the world in the next year, because basically anybody who wants a vaccine can get the vaccine here. You're not going to have a percentage of the population, I don't know, maybe as much as a quarter, that aren't going to get vaccinated. And it's basically done. So the vaccinated don't have to wear masks, but kids in school do have to wear masks. And that's going to be forever, because you're going to top out at a certain number of vaccinated. And then what do you do? COVID's not going away. So how does this make any sense?
Well, look, the CDC came out with a report back in March indicating that the K-12 schools are not associated with COVID-19 transmission, either within the schools themselves or out into the community, and that any of the cases that they're finding within schools appear to be brought in from the outside. They're not having transmission within the schools. So, you know, I and others have been arguing for months now that they ought to reopen the schools. And there was a lot of pushback from teachers' unions and other naysayers and people who are, quote, unquote, following the science, except they weren't following the science. But it seems pretty clear that schools can reopen, and they can reopen safely. So, you know, this business of not reopening them is nonsense.
And with kids not wearing masks, too.
Well, look, you know, as I wrote about a month ago, actually more than a month ago at this point, it was really back in early April, we were approaching a point where with the number of people vaccinated and therefore immune, and with the number of people who had natural immunity because they had been infected and recovered, we were probably getting close to where you could see herd immunity in the near future. And since that time, we've had a steady decline in cases, steady decline in hospitalizations, steady decline in deaths, and there's no reason to think that's not going to continue. So we've really reached a point at which we're pretty close to having, or maybe even at, herd immunity. I mean, in the over 12 population, more than 60% have received one dose of the vaccine. And the one dose of the vaccine is almost as effective as getting two doses. More than 50% have been fully vaccinated. And if you look at the most vulnerable people, the people over 65, 86% of them have gotten one dose, and 3/4 of them are fully vaccinated. So we've protected the most vulnerable people, the people who are in elementary schools. I mean, we don't want any of them to get sick, and we don't want them transmitting the disease. But the fact of the matter is, COVID-19 is just not that severe a disease for younger people. For people 17 and younger, they form 0.1% of all the COVID deaths.
Oh my gosh.
There's a vanishingly small number of kids. Any death is obviously too many. But if you're talking about a country of 330 million people, you have a vanishingly small number of COVID-related deaths in school-age kids.
Well, what about what some governors are doing? They're saying, if your kids get vaccinated, then they don't have to wear a mask at school. We've got Massachusetts, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. That's what they're offering. Do you think that would be a better incentive to try and get more people vaccinated?
Well, look, I think there's certainly no reason not to do that. But as I said, we're almost at the point where I think we know the demand for vaccines has been plummeting. And the reason it has been plummeting, they're vaccinating fewer people for the last few weeks than were vaccinated on Joe Biden's inauguration day. And the reason that you now have decreased demand is because of these falling numbers of cases. And the people who are remaining who are unvaccinated are largely younger people. And they or their parents are doing a mental calculus. They're saying, what's the benefit of a vaccine and what's the risk of a vaccine? And for some people, they've decided, well, I can risk getting COVID, which for most people in that age group is like a bad case of the flu, or I can take the vaccine. And some of them are making the decision not to do it. Now, I would urge everyone, when the vaccines become available for younger age groups, I'd urge people to take the vaccines. It's always better to not get sick and to not risk transmitting the disease. But, I can understand that the calculus that these people are engaging in.
But yeah. It's so mind-numbing. I mean, we're going to be throwing away close to 1 million vaccinations within the next 2 weeks because they're going to expire. You have 200,000 J&J shots in Ohio. You've got 25,000 in West Virginia. And it bothers me that we can't, get that to a country in need before it expires.
Well, look, the hesitancy about the J&J vaccine is a human manufactured crisis.
Yes.
The CDC put out a pause on these vaccines that lasted about 10, 11 days. It completely undermined confidence in those vaccines for something that it's still not even clear that there's a risk of blood clots from this, because it's not clear that it's much above the background incidence of these types of clots in the population. But you were still talking, even if it is an increase, you're talking about essentially a 1 in a million incidence of this complication. And now that you'd alerted physicians to look for it, you are going to be able to uncover it and treat it. So they really did a public disservice by issuing that alert and pausing the vaccine for those days. And it's no surprise now that people are reluctant to take the J&J vaccine and that we may end up wasting it here.
But by the time these COVIDians run out of ridiculous excuses and ludicrous hypotheticals, we'll be in the phase now where everybody has to get a booster shot, and then everything will be a mask up and blah, blah, blah until we reach 70% or 75% of people getting their booster shot. That's only months down the road, it would appear.
Well, look, no one knows yet if we're going to need booster shots. There's been a lot of speculation about it, but the data to this point indicate that people who have immunity from vaccines seem to maintain that immunity for at least 6 months to a year, and that people with immunity from natural infection maintain it for at least 6 months to a year. Whether that will continue or whether there'll be some new variant of the virus that arises, let's say, this coming winter, it's sort of the way we have with the influenza virus, so that you need new vaccines or you need a booster shot, we'll see. But at the moment, we don't know for sure that you're going to need any kind of booster shot.
Alameda County, California, issued a correction to the death toll from COVID in that county, down 25% from the previous reported number because they changed the definition of death by COVID. The state came up with a new definition. They had been counting any person who was positive for the virus at the time of death as part of the official tally. So they went from correlation to actual causation, which cause of death would speak to the need to focus on causation, I would think. But if other states adopt the same definition, boy, not that it changes much, but if this hysteria was induced in part because of the rolling death counts and case counts on CNN and so forth, and we reduce these numbers by 25%, and then we look at the demographics of those who actually died, and the number of cases or fatalities or even hospitalizations from people under 50 is even more infinitesimal than it already is. Boy, that would really be something, again, that speaks to the folly of these lockdowns and the folly of the COVID absolutists and so forth, wouldn't it?
Look, putting in a real accurate count out is very difficult, and there's no question there are an awful lot of people who had other diseases that were going to make them ill within a very short time and perhaps lead to their death, and they coincidentally had the COVID infection and they ended up being counted. That's clearly an overcount. So it's very difficult to know what's the actual count. Nevertheless, there's no question that COVID,
it was a lethal disease. Not as lethal, though, as the media would have you think, because all the media talks about are the confirmed cases, which are at this point are about 33 million. But in fact, we know, and this comes from the CDC and a lot of other sources, that there are many more people who were actually infected but never had a confirmed case, so that they there's an undercount, and if you're comparing it to the number of actual infections and then deaths, the infection fatality rate is probably only about 0.2 to 0.4%, which is, you know, on the order of influenza, maybe twice as much as influenza. But it's not like the Black Death. It's not like Ebola, where you have a 50% infection fatality rate.
He is Dr. Joel Zinberg, Senior Fellow at Competitive Enterprise Institute in D.C. and Associate Clinical Professor of Surgery at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Dr. Zinberg, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Sure thing.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I got to say, I'm a little suspect about our next guest because I watched the show The Americans.
Yeah.
And so I'm a little suspicious of husband and wife spy teams.
Oh.
It could be a sleeper cell.
I just watched Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
Well, okay.
Those were assassins. Right. It's not a spy team.
Yeah, that's also...
Go on,
that's
yes.
Also Drek. I'm talking about The Americans, which was a good show. License to Parent is a book by Christina Hillsburg with her husband, Ryan Hillsburg. They're both former CIA agents.
Oh, my gosh.
And I just want to make sure that we're not, like, suborning treasonous activity. Like, we're not going to be investigated by Bob Mueller for sedition by having Christina on the show. So let's see what she has to say about her, how her career as a spy helped her raise resourceful, self-sufficient kids and see if it sounds communistic at all to you.
Okay, I'll let you know.
Christina Hillsburg, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Your time as a CIA agent and your husband, CIA agent as well, retired, former, right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So give us the key takeaway that mere civilians wouldn't think could apply to parenting that the CIA experience gives you the insight to affect.
Absolutely. License to Parent is part memoir, part parenting guide. And it tells the story of my career at the CIA and how I met my husband, who, like you said, was also a CIA spy, and my journey into parenthood. And instead of becoming the anxious helicopter parent that I always thought I would be, like is so common these days, I use CIA principles to give my kids more freedom than I ever expected. And so throughout the book, my husband Ryan and I share how we use these techniques with our now 5 kids, and we give practical takeaways along the way.
Well, it must have been difficult. I mean, because you started raising 3 of his children from his first marriage and then later 2 of your own together. Was that difficult?
That's right. You know, he was already parenting when I met him, and really that's the genesis of this book. I was so fascinated by the way that he was parenting his 3 kids that he was finding a way to adapt these 2 parts of my life that had once seemed so different. You know, he was adapting these CIA techniques and skills in simple, straightforward ways. Because at the end of the day, we want our kids to be prepared to take on whatever life throws at them. And that's what the CIA does for its officers. So we're giving them these skills for life.
So in addition to waterboarding your kids to keep them in line, what else did you learn at CIA that's applicable?
We talk about some of the more physical skills that you would think of when you think of CIA, you know, not waterboarding,
but yeah,
things like how to spot and avoid danger, how to be prepared for emergency scenarios. But we also talk about a lot of the softer skills that you often don't think of when you're looking at, you know, watching a Hollywood film about espionage. It's about communication. It's about writing. You know, a lot of people don't realize that one of a spy's most prized traits is their ability to write well. And these skills that we can give our kids to help them be excellent communicators is going to set them up for success in life.
Does it help, though, that mom and dad can just whisper in the kids' ears and say, you know, mommy and daddy have licenses to kill? Just remember that. Does that help at all?
You know, it's funny. People assume, you know, we get a lot, well, you guys were spies, so you must spy on your kids, right? You know, can you help me do this with my kids' phones? But we actually advocate for more autonomy and less surveillance, which I think comes as a surprise to a lot of people.
Well, I know a couple who they put a hidden camera in their daughter's bedroom because they thought she was doing drugs. And I think that is such an invasion of her privacy.
Absolutely.
So
I would agree.
With parenting tips, we don't want to do that, correct?
That's right. We want to give our kids opportunities for autonomy so that, one, they can build confidence, and two, you can build trust with them. And when you have a relationship of trust with your kids, you're going to have more of an ability to guide them and set them up for life. And so we talk a lot in the book about how the CIA builds trust and loyalty with their intelligence assets and how we use that same skill set to build trust with our kids and teach our kids to build trust and positive relationships with others.
Well, so you mentioned about, you know, being able to spot situations, understand your surroundings. I mean, what just develop that a little bit more in terms of what, you know, kids as they get a little bit older can do just to make sure that their mom and dad don't need to helicopter them because they're aware of what's going on and they're acting in an intelligent way.
Sure. It all comes back to this principle that we learn in CIA training called get off the X. And it's about finding danger, and danger can be a person, a place, a thing, an environment, and it's about moving away from it as quickly as possible. And so that is the main concept that we emphasize with our kids. And so the ways that we discuss it practically is teaching them to listen to their gut, you know, going against that curious feeling when you see something up ahead and you want to get closer, listening to your gut and doing the opposite, right? We talk about not freezing in a scenario, and a way to make sure that you don't do that is to visualize, if you had to get out of here, where are the exits? Having that escape plan in your mind. And then also listening to alarms and warning signals. You know, data shows that during 9/11, a large percentage of survivors actually delayed their evacuation to do things like shut down their computers, change their shoes. And so we want our kids to treat all alarms and warning signals as the real thing and move as quickly as possible. And then lastly, one that I think is not really intuitive for a lot of parents is teaching our kids that it's okay to ignore authority figures if necessary. And in the book, we talk about the South Korean ferry disaster and about how, you know, most of the people who perished were young kids because the voice of authority over the intercom told them to stay put. And had they not stayed put, they may have survived. And so we want our kids to be able to think critically in those situations to move away from danger.
Have you thought about writing a follow-up book, Parenting During a Pandemic?
Yeah, I think everybody's thought of writing that book. We've all been in the thick of it, for sure. I do talk a little bit about the pandemic in the book. I was writing the manuscript during the pandemic, which is a very interesting time to be writing a book with all five of your kids at home.
Oh, I don't know how you did it. But what did you learn, though, as a parent during this whole last 15 months?
You know, I talk in the book about this idea of perfection. And when the pandemic started, there were so many parents that, you know, were dealing with homeschooling. And I remember just kind of scrolling through my social media feed and seeing all these activities people were setting up with their kids. And it's so easy to, like, look at these curated images on our news feeds and think, oh, this mom has it all together. Look at this perfect activity she's setting up for her kids. And so I had to realize during the pandemic that we're all doing what we need and we're seeing, you know, what people have chosen to post, and we shouldn't let that intimidate us, you know, and make us not want to try things ourselves. And, you know, that was something that I then decided, you know what, I am going to do my little version of homeschool. We do it in our treehouse we call them the bigs and the littles. So I did that for my littles. And I realized that it doesn't need to be perfect. It just needs to be good enough. And we talk about that concept a lot in the book. Perfection is the enemy of good. Knowing when good is good enough. And, you know, we're going to have some type of homeschool. It may not look like a perfectly glamorous, you know, Instagram shot, but, you know, it's ours and the kids love it. And we're all just doing the best that we can.
She is Christina Hillsburg, former CIA analyst and author of the book License to Parent, How My Career as a Spy Helped Me Raise Resourceful, Self-Sufficient Kids. Christina, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and I guess we have to complete this survey from your CPS overlords.
Yeah.
Wait, what's the survey about?
Well, it's a plan for next school year. What's going to make you feel safe, Dan? What's going to make your kids feel safe?
Not being in CPS. Oh, End of survey.
Oh, stop it.
So what else you got?
Well, first of all, I want to know what you want to check here. What box? Are we going to be black today? Are we going to be Latino? Oh, not sorry. It's not Latino. It's Latinx.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want, because they're also Native American. So every time I got to decide, because I've got some black in them, all this. You know, what do you want to check for the boys?
What I
multiracial. Let's do that one. I'll just click that box. Okay. Here's what's going to make you feel safe sending your kids back to school.
Armed.
No, that's not one of them.
Well, then write in your answers.
So here are the choices. This is what makes me so mad. The choices are, I want them to have none of the above, but here they are. Section 2, returning for school year 2021-22. What safety measures would make you comfortable returning to school in person? 1, wearing masks. Of course, that's number 1. 2, social distancing in the classroom. Social distancing during meals. Social distancing during busing and transportation. Ventilation air purifiers, excuse me, increasing vaccination access for students and staff, hand washing, sanitizing access areas, or care rooms.
Oh my gosh.
No, these are your choices. Care rooms to separate students who may display symptoms during the day.
Yes.
Which one are we going to check?
Everybody should be in their own padded room. I agree.
You agree?
Including the parents for sending their kids to these schools that would send out this survey.
Well, why don't we have none of the above? Because I don't know which one to click. And you can't advance forward in the survey unless you know which one to click. So which one would you click?
How about you don't fill out the survey? How about you print it out and you write in the answers and you make copies and you put it in everybody's mail slot at Allman Brothers High School?
It's not Allman. It's Amundsen
Whatever.
High School. So, but yeah, I don't know which one to put. I'll just put ventilation, air purifier. I don't care about any of that. This is all theater. This is all garbage. You know what this means? This means we're still going to have to social distance in the fall. This means we're still going to have to wear masks. And it just means a life of hell. They already send out, for if you want to watch your kids participate in sports, only 60% capacity for the fall for football. We're outside, okay? It's the same thing. It's the same stupid rules, and everything that we've been doing for the last 15 months is going to continue.
Of course it is. Who's surprised by that? You're not. You can't be.
I am surprised.
How can you be surprised?
Because the pandemic's over. Everybody's opening up. Tonight at midnight, folks, we're off the COVID bridge as we enter phase 5 that starts at midnight. Everything's going to be open. Cubs game's going to be 100% capacity,
yeah,
which is tomorrow. It's going to be packed. You're going to have traffic, you guys, like you haven't seen in 15 months. It's going to get real around here, but except for our children. Well, I don't like the fact that they're still in school for 2 days because we're still in school until the end of June.
It's exhausting. It's exhausting to listen to. I mean, it's exhausting. I don't know. It's just like a fly trapped in an upside down glass.
No, I know.
You're just flying around, bumping into sides. You can't figure out. And you and the collective CPS, the entire sort of CPS diaspora, they just can't figure out how to get out. They just keep bumping into stuff.
Here's another question: how confident are you in your child's ability to follow the following guidelines? Can your child wear a mask for the entire school day? And can your child practice social distancing? I mean, you got to be kidding.
You know right. You know what CPS, the average CPS administrator got on the SAT?
No.
Drool. all right. Let's do a good example. Since you've given us the bad example of education, here's a good story.
Okay.
Homeroom Angel in Green Bay, a wealthy donor in Green Bay, Wisconsin, donated $1,000 to each teacher in the Green Bay Area Catholic Education Network, which everyone calls GRACE. Nearly 190 teachers will receive the bonus.
Oh, good for them.
ZipRecruiter puts the average teacher salary at a Catholic school in Green Bay at less than $42,000. You want to compare that to that totalitarian indoctrination camp you send your kids to? $42,000. The CPS teachers, by contrast, are the highest paid teachers adjusted for cost of living in the nation. And that was before their bump last year. $140,000 in, which is really $40,000 in, $2.1 million guaranteed pension payout for the median teacher. And that's that stat's about 2 years old. That's what we're talking about here.
Oh, my God. It's
first
crime.
Meanwhile, in Green Bay, where they care about educating children, by contrast, first grade teacher Nicole Hall intends to set some of the money, the $1,000 aside for her classroom, as a way to remember the gift. She felt humbled and honored that somebody cared enough about the work that they were doing and recognized the challenge they're facing. The person who donated the money has a relationship with Grace and was able to witness the benefits of in-person learning during the pandemic, said Grace's president.
Yeah, Catholics don't get COVID. No, I don't mean to make light of it. I honestly, if it wasn't for the Catholic schools, we would not be even in school for 2 days.
As life is returning to normal, the plexiglass is coming down, masks are coming off, no virtual option in the fall up in Green Bay. How did they make it through? The president there says credits the school's faith and her innovative, positive, mission-driven teachers. Yeah, and apparently that donor agrees. Anybody volunteering to sprinkle the infield with CPS teachers with $1,000?
Heck no. They took vaccines away from people who needed it under the guise of, oh, we'll go back if we have just one vaccine. Then you gave them the one vaccine. Then they needed two vaccines. And then after that, they needed something else and something else. Then they wanted us to get our kids vaccinated. They're extortionists, yes.
Yeah, well, you continue to pay.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.